Welcome to the History of Chemistry podcast. I'm Steve Cohen, your host, and this is episode 89, Pathological Science, on some pseudoscientific discoveries in chemistry. Thanks to those who already support this podcast. Support the continuation of this podcast at Patreon. The website is www.patreon.com/thehistoryofchemistry. No history of science would be complete without apparent discoveries that turned out to be false, yet not just false, but pathological. The phrase pathological science was invented by none other than chemist Irving Langmuir late in life on December 18, 1953, for a lecture he gave at Princeton University. The topic was supposed scientific discoveries that were flawed at their heart, or, as he put it, quote, the science of things that aren't so, unquote. And he described six, quote, symptoms of pathological science, unquote. 1. The maximum effect that is observed is produced by a causative agent of barely detectable intensity, and the magnitude of the effect is substantially independent of the intensity of the cause. 2. The effect is of a magnitude that remains close to the limit of detectability, or many measurements are necessary because of the very low statistical significance of the results. 3. Claims of great accuracy. 4. Fantastic theories contrary to experience. 5. Criticisms are met by ad hoc excuses thought up on the spur of the moment. 6. Ratio of supporters to critics rises up to somewhere near 50% and then falls gradually to oblivion. Langmuir, though a physical chemist, described essentially pathological physics in his talk. So, for this episode, I want to look at some 20th century examples of pathological chemistry. Two of them still linger in the public mind in some way. The first example is polywater. For most people, chemists included, this is now a forgotten and embarrassing part of pseudoscience. For the beginnings, we return to the Soviet Union in 1961 and to the obscure laboratory of Nikolai Fedyakin in Kostroma, some distance from Moscow. He was studying what happened to plain old water when it was forced through or condensed in quartz capillary tubes. A capillary tube is an inflexible tube with narrow diameter, often made of metal or glass. Why did he research this? He was investigating an idea that Lord Kelvin noticed nearly a century earlier, that a large amount of water in a bowl evaporates slower than separate water drops, and that such evaporation is even slower from water inside a glass tube. So Fedyakin put some water into a quartz tube with an inner diameter of a hair, sealed it shut, and left it to sit standing up for a few weeks. He looked at the capillary under a microscope and found that the water was separated into two portions, like salad dressing separates into oil and vinegar. He continued his experiments and was able to see that the water in the bottom of the capillary was denser than regular water. He wrote up a report and published it in a Russian scientific journal. Who should read and get curious about the report than none other than Boris Deryagin, who was interested also in chemical vapor deposition of diamond, as I mentioned in episode 82. Deryagin wanted to become internationally famous, and weird and wacky water might help his reputation. So he corresponded and eventually began collaborating with Fedyakin. Deryagin's researchers in Moscow confirmed what Fedyakin saw about two layers of water. The denser layer froze not at 0 degrees Celsius, but at minus 40 degrees Celsius, and also boiled not at 100 degrees Celsius, but at somewhere around 200 degrees Celsius. We know that most objects expand in a predictable way when heated, and this oddball water expanded more than regular water, and it refracted light more. Ultimately, Deryagin concluded that this wacky water was more thermodynamically stable than regular water. This means that regular water would inevitably turn into weird water over time, though how long is unknown because thermodynamics tells you if something is more stable, while kinetics tells you the speed of the change. By 1966, Deryagin got Soviet permission to go to the Western world, to the University of Nottingham in England, where I spent a year 2 decades later to talk at a conference. The title of the talk was couched in scientific jargon. Quote, "Effects of lyophile surfaces on the properties of boundary liquid films," unquote. So few came to hear him or get interested. But one British chemist did come and hear, Brian Pethica at Unilever Research Laboratory. Pethica then spent several years reproducing Deryagin's and Fedyakin's results. He confirmed the weirdness, including that it was gel-like, but couldn't figure out what chemically was different from regular water. Pethica hypothesized that maybe the quartz tube was leaching out silicates into the water, except this seemed unreasonable because quartz just doesn't do that. Even so, he was able to publish a paper about what he called anomalous water in the prestigious journal Nature, and so Americans finally learned about it. Now Deryagin was becoming famous, and maybe this would lead to a Nobel Prize. There was quite a controversy over this paper. Some researchers doubted the whole affair, saying that all water, when mixed with anomalous water, would become anomalous. The research also fanned interest in Kurt Vonnegut's recent science fiction novel, Cat's Cradle, which describes a military weapon called Ice 9, a different structure of ice that melts at higher temperatures than regular water, and converts all regular water into its structure. This could really be dangerous. How could Vonnegut have predicted anomalous water? Finally, a spectrometer sensitive enough to probe the tiny samples of anomalous water was used to examine it. Ellis Lippincott at the University of Maryland and Robert Stromberg and Warren Grant at the National Bureau of Standards published a paper in the journal Science in June 1969 in which they found a non-water spectrum, but with only trace amounts of sodium and silicon. They suggested a network like a molecular honeycomb, a polymer, but of water. So they called this anomalous water polywater. Now scientists became really scared of this substance. Of course, the CIA had to get involved because polywater was discovered in the USSR. I also call attention for you fans of Star Trek to the episode from 1966 called The Naked Time, which revolved around a problem with polywater. By an April 1970 conference at Lehigh University on polywater, the doubters and proponents of polywater were ready to battle it out. Deryagin appeared at the conference for the opening speech, but got a bunch of skeptical questions tossed to him, especially about impurities some research groups found in polywater. He merely answered, quote, "I can't be responsible for the results that are bad and not by us," unquote. On the other hand, Lippincott couldn't repeat his findings and complained of impurities, and his colleague Stromberg said, quote, "With the evidence we had, we started out believing that water forms a polymer. New evidence casts serious doubt, unquote. A postdoctoral researcher at Bell Labs, Dennis Rousseau, was even more vocal. He said that the samples were very highly contaminated with chloride, oxygen, carbon, sodium, and potassium. He even shone a laser, a new lab toy as we discussed, onto a sample, and the water turned dark brown, which is evidence that the stuff wasn't water at all. Ultimately, no one convinced anyone else at the conference, either pro or con, to change his mind. But after the conference, Rousseau went further on his research. He played some handball and squeezed his sweat from his t-shirt into a cuvette and inserted it into an infrared spectrometer. Lo and behold, the sweaty spectrum matched the polywater spectrum. He published his results in January 1971, saying that polywater is merely sweaty water. There is no anomaly. Move along, folks. There is nothing to see here. Not until August 1973 did Deryagin, in a letter to the journal Nature, himself concede that he was wrong. And polywater gained a place in the Pathological Chemistry Hall of Fame. Let's move forward to the current era of our chemical history, to June 1988. A team of scientists, including a French physician, Jacques Benveniste, published a paper in the journal Nature on how an antibody diluted to the extreme still seemed to have an immunological effect. In essence, he claimed that water has some kind of memory about what was dissolved in it, even when there was no chance of even one molecule of antibody. This supports the pseudoscience of homeopathic medicine. Naturally, this alleged observation does not follow from current understanding of chemistry and physics. The idea was so controversial that the editor of Nature, John Maddox, published an accompanying note saying, quote, "There are good and particular reasons why prudent people should, for the time being, suspend judgment," unquote. Maddox also required that the experiments be redone with carefully picked skeptics to review Benveniste's work to ensure that the results were reproducible. So Maddox had Benveniste reproduce his experiments following the exact protocol that Benveniste laid out in his original report. There was one catch, though. The skeptics observed that Benveniste and colleagues could tell which test tubes had antibodies and which did not. So they redid the experiments with the lab work videotaped, the test tubes coded secretly, and wrapped labels in newspaper, put them in an envelope, and mount them on the lab's ceiling out of view of the researchers. And guess what? Benveniste's work was not reproducible. Maddox had a report published in the July 1988 issue of Nature. The conclusion was, quote, "that there is no substantial basis for the claim that anti-IgE at high dilution by factors as great as 10 to 120 power retains its biological effectiveness, and that the hypothesis that water can be imprinted with the memory of past solutes is as unnecessary as it is fanciful," unquote. Not only that, but there was a financial bias in the paper. Two of Benveniste's team were paid by Boiron, a homeopathic company. Benveniste, of course, was enraged and complained of witch hunts and McCarthy-like prosecutions under an ordeal. After some back and forth, the editors at Nature stopped the discussion, but the idea was now out there, and people began jumping on the memory water bandwagon. Experiments continued through the 1990s, even to the point of a 1997 report claiming that memory water could be transmitted by telephone, and by 2000 when a paper claimed of transmission over the internet. Independent researchers under the American Physical Society found no positive results except when Benveniste researchers themselves did the work. Multiple failures from the 1990s onward continued to cast doubt on this memory effect. It just doesn't exist, but reappears like a whack-a-mole game because of social media. Water memory is yet another example of pathological chemistry.
We'll be right back.
Hi, and welcome to Hiss and Tell, a cat podcast where we delve deep into the fascinating world of feline behavior with your host, me, Christina Wilson, a professional animal behaviorist. Each episode features insightful discussions with leading veterinarians, dedicated researchers and scientists, experts in cat behavior and training, and so much more. Join me as we decode the complexities of pet loss, unravel the mysteries of feline health and behavior, and discover the latest research findings. I'll meet you at Hiss and Tell.
So a brief foray into the pseudoscience of homeopathy is in order. I am not a physician, so I won't talk much about the relative merits or problems of medical treatments. Rather, I will analyze homeopathy from a chemical perspective. The practice of homeopathy was founded by a German doctor named Samuel Hahnemann, who gave up his medical practice in 1784, at least partially, because he was opposed to bloodletting. He shifted to writing and translating medical works and discovered a book by William Cullen called A Treatise on the Materia Medica, which claimed that the bark of a Peruvian tree, cinchona, could work against malaria. We know this to be testable and true, but scientific knowledge at the time didn't understand the reasons, and Cullen's book argued that cinchona's bitterness was the reason for its effectiveness. Based on Cullen's work, Hahnemann decided that like cures like, that a substance that gives healthy people disease symptoms will cure sick people with those symptoms. He developed this idea and published his beliefs in a paper in 1807, in which he coined the term homeopathy. Fair enough, but now we know about the germ theory of disease formulated in the mid-1800s, in which bacteria and viruses cause many illnesses. We know of diseases caused by deficiencies in certain chemical compounds, like scurvy from lack of vitamin C. We know of diseases caused by defects in the genetic code, DNA. Homeopathy doesn't fit in with any of known disease-causing mechanisms. Even more so, homeopathy insists upon diluting down whatever chemical substance the medicine is supposed to be with distilled water or alcohol and shaken, because Hahnemann believed that dilution increased the medication's potency and shaking activated some sort of vital energy. That sounds an awful lot like the discredited vital theory of organic compounds, now completely obsolete. The dilution, of course, is nonsense, for diluting something by a factor of 10, 100 times means there can't even be a single molecule of whatever the remedy is within the solvent. In fact, there is no evidence whatsoever that homeopathic substances have any effect. In a word, homeopathy is bogus from the chemical point of view. It doesn't matter that pharmacies the world over display these so-called remedies, or that insurance companies are suckered into paying for this stuff on, ultimately, your dime or whatever small coinage your country uses. It doesn't matter that a lot of people believe in its effectiveness. Belief is not evidence. Experiments prove otherwise. It still is phony baloney. Our third and final example of pathological chemistry dates from 1989, when British chemist Martin Fleischmann and American Stanley Pons published an article in the Journal of Electroanalytical Chemistry on an apparatus they built that generated excess heat than expected, unless you took into account some kind of nuclear reaction. Their apparatus sat on a small tabletop, which electrolyzed heavy water using a palladium metal electrode. In other words, they applied electricity to electrodes immersed in heavy water, that is, deuterium oxide. Recall that deuterium is a type of hydrogen which has a neutron in its nucleus. Hence, it is heavier than regular hydrogen. If this experiment were true, then perhaps easy and cheap electricity is available to every household. Because there was no huge nuclear reactor, and all the high temperatures and risks, as in Chernobyl, we've heard of, this alleged process was called cold fusion. Their work was originally based on the long-known behavior of palladium metal to absorb hydrogen atoms into its crystal structure, now considered to be a palladium-hydrogen alloy. This property is also under consideration for storage of hydrogen gas as a fuel. In the 1920s, Austrians Kurt Peters and Friedrich Pannet claimed that they could get the hydrogen to turn into helium by nuclear fusion with this process, but they retracted their paper later. Pons and Fleischmann, in the 1980s, wondered if the mobility of deuterium atoms in palladium metal with compression would cause nuclear fusion, hence their experiment. They used a calorimeter, which we have discussed, an instrument designed to measure the heat emitted or absorbed during a chemical reaction. During their research, the heat in equaled the heat out, and the temperature stayed around 30 degrees Celsius. A few of their experiments, though, showed a sudden rise in temperature to about 50 degrees Celsius, but no changes in input power to the experiment were made. One of the reviewers of a proposal for grant money by Pons and Fleischmann to continue their research was American scientist Stephen Jones, who was familiar with another cold fusion method using subatomic particles called muons. Jones started to correspond and meet with the duo and compare results. Eventually, they decided to publish all their results simultaneously to avoid patent and other problems. They prepared for publication in March 1989 in the journal, once again, Nature. But Pons's university put pressure on the electrochemical work to be published first, so the duo sent their paper to the Journal of Electroanalytical Chemistry under the title Electrochemically Induced Nuclear Fusion of Deuterium. Naturally, this angered Jones, who sent his paper to Nature anyway. Pons and Fleischmann's news was a scientific bombshell. Within 2 weeks, the American Chemical Society had its semi-annual conference in Dallas, Texas, where thousands of chemists from all over the world converged. The ACS rented out the local indoor sports stadium and held a special lecture on cold fusion called Nuclear Fusion in a Test Tube. I can speak of this personally because I was there in the stadium as a graduate student. There are videos of this event on YouTube, and perhaps you can find me somewhere in the stands if you squint at the videos. Honestly, most chemists didn't know what to make of the whole proceedings. The ACS gave out free copies of that issue of the Journal of Electroanalytical Chemistry to attendees. But, as pathological science, the experiments didn't stand up to scrutiny. Within a couple of months, so many failures to repeat Pons and Fleischmann's work occurred that symposia were canceled. Physicist Douglas Morrison was the first to call the results pathological science that year. Within a couple of years, a cold fusion institute in Utah closed down because of no funding. By the late 1990s, the scientific community regarded it as pseudoscience, despite that a few lone scientists even now keep at the topic. So, no cold fusion either. What makes these three examples pathological science if we apply Langmuir's criteria. First and second, the alleged effects are barely detectable, if at all, and hard to pin down with lousy statistical significance. Fourth, there are fantastic claims in all of them running counter to the best knowledge available. Fifth, some of these examples had spur-of-the-moment excuses to justify their results. And sixth, after initial excitement, most scientists have walked away. The third one, claims of great accuracy vary. Polywater had some testable accurate properties, as did cold fusion. In our next episode, we learn about the next revolution to appear in chemistry, the use of electronic computers, particularly in the 1980s. Until then, brave the elements! Thank you for listening to the History of Chemistry podcast.